Hachette Audio presents The 620 Man, written by David Baldacci, read by Zachary Weber, Mella Lee, and Christine Lakin. Dedication. To Anthony Forbes Watson, my brilliant UK publisher and dear friend. You taught me a lot during our time together, and not just about books and publishing, but about great French wines and important moral philosophies. Wherever your future path takes you, I will be cheering you on, and our friendship will endure, as all true friendships do. Chapter 1. Travis Devine took a shallow breath, ignored the heat and humidity that was rising fast along with the sun, and rushed to board the 620 train, like it was the last flight out of Saigon. He was wearing an off-the-rack pearl-gray suit, a wrinkled white shirt that needed laundering, and a muted dark tie. He would rather be in jeans and a t-shirt, or camis and army jump boots, but that couldn't happen. Not on this ride. He was freshly showered, although already starting to perspire. His thick hodgepodge of hair was as neatly combed as he could manage it. His face was shaved and mildly scented with a nondescript cologne. He wore cheap tasseled loafers shined fore and aft. The imitation leather briefcase held his company-issued laptop with special encryption and no personal use permitted thereon, along with breath mints and a packet of Pepcid AC. He no longer took the neat little power pills he'd popped when suited up to fight for his country. The army used to give them out like gummy bears so the grunts would battle longer and harder on less sleep and less to eat. Now they cost money. His primary weapons, instead of the army-issued M4 carbine and M9 sidearm of yesteryear, were twin Apple Mac 27-inch screens connected by digital tethers to mighty encrypted clouds, seeded with all the data he would ever need. It was all bullshit, really, and strangely enough, more important to him than anything else on Earth right now. What they taught you in the world of high finance was simple, really. Win or lose. Eat or starve. It was a binary choice. No Taliban or Afghan soldier pretending to be your ally before banging around into the back of your head. Here, his chief concerns were quarterly earnings projections, liquidity, free and closed markets, monopolies and oligarchies, in-house lawyers who wanted you to stick to the rules, and bosses who insisted that you didn't. And most significant of all, the person sitting right next to Devine at the office. They were mortal foes. It was him or them in Wall Street's version of mixed martial arts. Devine was commuting south to the big city on Metro North's Harlem line. At age 32, his entire life had changed, and he wasn't sure how he felt about it. No, he was sure. He hated it. That meant things were working according to plan. He sat where he always did when commuting into the city, third row window seat on the starboard side. He switched to the port side on the way back. The train puttered along with no real ambition, unlike the humans it carried. Sleek trains ran like cheetahs in Europe and Asia, but here they were snails. Yet they were faster than the cars stuck in the murderous traffic that piled in and out of the city morning, noon, and night. Generations before him had ridden this very same route to make their living in the sweatshop spires of Manhattan. Many had died along the way from the usual suspects, widowmaker heart attacks, strokes, aneurysms, the slow death of neurological disorders and cancers, a liver painfully scuttled by too much alcohol, or self-inflicted deaths among those who could take the strain no longer. Devine lived in Mount Kisco, in a saggy townhouse shared with 320-somethings trying to forge their futures in various ways. He had left them all asleep as he tried to shape his future day by day. The train would continue to fill as it wended its way along to Manhattan. It was summer, the sun was well on its way up, and the heat was building. He could have lived in the city and paid a lot more money for the easier commute, but he liked trees and open spaces, and being surrounded by skyscrapers and concrete at all times was not his preference. He had actually been mulling over where to live when a realtor who knew a friend of his had called out of the blue and told him she had found him a room at the townhouse. It was cheap enough that he was able to save a bit, and lots of people commuted into the city, even though it made for long days and nights. But that philosophy had been beaten into his psyche for most of his life. "You work till you drop, Travis," his father had told him over and over. "Nobody in this world gives you a damn thing. You have to take it, and you take it by working harder than anybody else. Look at your sister and brother. You think they had it easy?" Yes, his older brother and sister, Danny and Claire, board-certified neurosurgeon at the Mayo Clinic and CFO of a Fortune 100, respectively. They were 8 and 9 years older than he was, and already minted superstars. They had reached heights he never would. He had been told this so often, nothing could persuade him not to believe it. Devine's birth had clearly been a mistake. Whether his father forgot the condom, or his mother didn't realize she was ovulating and failed to keep her lustful man at bay, out he had popped and pissed off everybody in his family. His mother went back to work immediately at his father's thriving dental practice in Connecticut, where she was a hygienist. He'd learned this later, of course, but maybe he'd also sensed his parents' indifference to him as an infant. That indifference had turned to fury when Devine was a senior in high school. That was when he'd been accepted into West Point. His father had roared, "Playing soldier instead of going out into the world and earning a living? Well, boy, you are off the family payroll starting now. Your mother and I don't deserve this crap." However, he'd found his place in the world of the military. After graduating from West Point, he'd gone through the arduous Ranger School, passing the crawl, walk, and run tests, which was how the three phases were described. By far the hardest part had been sleep deprivation. He and his comrades had literally fallen unconscious while standing up. He'd later qualified to become a member of the elite 75th Ranger Regiment. That had been even tougher than Ranger School, but he had loved the special forces and the dangerous and demanding quick strike missions that came with being a member. These were serious accomplishments, and he had written to his parents about them, hoping for some praise. He had never heard back from his mother. His father had sent an email asking him what national park he would be assigned to now that he was a ranger. He had signed the email, "Proud Father of Smokey the Bear." He might have assumed his dad was utilizing his sense of humor, only he knew his father didn't have one. Devine had earned twin purples, a silver star, and a slew of other bits of metal and ribbons. In the world of the Army, he was known as a combat stud. He would only term himself a survivor. He had gone into uniform as a boy and come out as a war machine. 6'1" and 1/4 inches, as the Army had precisely measured him, he had entered West Point a lanky 180 pounds of average physique. Then the Army and his own determination had transformed him into 225 pounds of bone, muscle, and gristle. His grip was like the jaws of a croc, his stamina was off the charts, his skills at killing and not being killed placed him at the top of the food chain with orcas and great whites. He'd risen to captain right on schedule and had worn the twin silver bars proudly. But then Devine had called it quits because he had to. It had torn him up back then. It still tore him up. He was an Army man through and through until he could be one no longer. Yet it was a decision he had to make. After that, he had sat in an apartment for a month wondering what to do, while old comrades phoned, emailed, and texted, asking him what the hell he was doing leaving the uniform. He had not gotten back to any of them. He had nothing he could say to them. A leader who had never had an issue giving orders and being in command, he couldn't find the words to explain what he had done. He did have the post-9/11 GI Bill to help him. It paid for a full ride to an in-state public university. It seemed a fair trade-off for nearly dying for his country. He'd gotten his MBA that way. He was the oldest person in his class at Cowell & Cumley, the minted powerhouse investment firm where he worked at an entry-level analyst position. When he'd applied at Cowell, he knew they had looked upon him with suspicion because of his age and unusual background. They had outwardly thanked him for his military service because that was always automatic, but they probably had to fill a veteran's quota, and he was it. He didn't care why they had picked him, so long as he got a shot to make himself as miserable as possible. Yes, he thought as he stared out the window. As miserable as possible. He had tried later trains into the city, but there were too many suits on board just like him, heading to work, heading to war. He needed to get there first, because whoever got there first, with the most, often was victorious. The military had also taught him that. And so he stepped onto the 6:20 train every morning and traveled to the city as punishment. And as much as he hated the work and the life that came with it, that penance would never manage to match his crime. Chapter 2. The 6:20 train passed through bucolic countryside, lurking outside a metropolis of unequaled breadth and complexity. Along the way, it picked up people at stations set in affluent small towns that existed mostly to serve the hungry beast due south. It finally chugged past an enclave of homes that were some of the most expensive in the country. It seemed unfair to call them mere homes. A place nearly as large as a shopping center should have a grander name. Even mansion or estate didn't cut it, Devine thought. Palace, maybe. Yeah, palace seemed to work. He lifted his gaze from his laptop, as he did every morning when passing by this area. Every time he looked out, another structure was going up, or an existing one was being made even more lavish. The cement trucks drove in with wet loads for larger and more elaborate pools. The houses went higher or wider, or a guest house was being built or a putting green added. It kept the working class employed, so there was some good in the greed and pretentiousness, he supposed. The train slowed as it approached a bend and lazily snaked upward over a lumpy knoll. It slowed some more, coming nearly to a stop. There was a signal switching hitch here that the train people either couldn't or wouldn't do anything about. To say they had a monopoly was to say the earth revolved around the sun, so why would they give a damn? And as they came to a complete halt, Devine saw her. He had seen her only a few times before, and only when the weather turned warm. He had no idea why she was up so early, but he was glad she was. The privacy wall was high, but not high enough to block the sight line of those on the train at this point on the knoll. He knew who the owner of this particular palace was, and he also knew that there were height limits on perimeter walls and fences here. The owner had planted trees along the rear wall to compensate for this, but because of the space between the bottom of the tree canopy and the top of the wall, there was a fairly large gap that one could see through. It was an oversight, he knew, that the owner would no doubt rectify one day, though Devine hoped not, at least while he was riding the 6:20. He felt a bit like Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, the champion voyeur movie of all time, but he wasn't looking out the window because his leg was broken and he was bored, as was the case with Stewart's character. He was looking out the window because of her. The woman had sauntered out from the rear door of the largest palace in this enclave. Sauntered was the only word that worked for how she moved. It was a smooth, leisurely pace, like a panther just getting warmed up before breaking into a sprint. The hips and glutes and thighs and shoulders all moved in the most gloriously primal choreography. The place looming behind her was all modernistic, with glass and metal and concrete whipped into odd geometric shapes. Only the mind of an architectural savant snorting nostrils of coke could have conceived it. She had on a short white terry cloth robe that clung to her tanned thighs. When she took it off, revealed was an emerald green string bikini and a body that seemed too flawless to be genuine. Her hair was all blonde highlights with intricate cuts and waves that had probably cost more than his suit. Devine looked around to see who else was watching. All the guys were, of course. One of the women had glanced up from her computer, seen the lady in question, looked at the gents with their faces burned to the glass, and turned back to her screen in disgust. Two other women, one in her 40s and dressed like a hippie, and one in her 70s, didn't look up. The former was on her phone. The latter was diligently reading her Bible, which had plenty of warnings about sins of the flesh. The bikini lady placed her painted toenails in the water, shivered slightly, and then in she dove. She did a graceful arc under the water, pushed off the other side, and came back up to where she had started. She hoisted herself out and sat on the pool surround facing his way. She didn't seem to notice the train or anyone staring from inside it. Devine could imagine at this distance, all she might see was the train's glass reflecting the sunlight. With her body wet, the tiny bikini seemed to have shrunk, and her breasts hung heavy and firm in the twin pockets of the swimsuit top. She looked to the left and right, and then behind her at the house. Next, she slipped off her top, and then her bottom. She sat there for a long moment, totally naked. Devine could glimpse commingled white and tanned skin. Then she jumped once more into the water and vanished. It was about this time that the train started up again, and the next palace in the enclave appeared, only it didn't have a beautiful woman skinny dipping in its pool. In fact, this homeowner had planted not trees, but tall, thick Leland cypresses that left no gaps through which one could peer. Pretty much every other man on the train car groaned under his breath and slumped back with a mix of ecstasy and disappointment. Devine eyed some of them. They looked back at him, smiled, shook their heads, and mouthed things that sounded basically like, "Dude, what the fuck was that?" Devine had never seen her stripped down before. He wondered what had caused her to do it beyond some sort of playful impulse. He wondered about many things in that particular palace. It was fascinating to him what people did with all that money. Some were philanthropic, others just kept buying bigger toys. Devine told himself that if he ever got to be that rich, he would not buy the toys, he would give it all away. Yeah, sure you would. At the next station, more people got on, and then at the next station, still more. As he looked around at the mostly 20-somethings on the train, who were already on their fired-up laptops and yanking down data clouds and scanning documents and fine-tuning presentations and excelling at Excel, Devine knew that the enemy was everywhere. He was completely surrounded, and that should have panicked the former soldier. And yet, this morning, all Devine could think about was the naked woman in the water, and it wasn't for the obvious reasons. To the former ranger and army scout, something about the lovely woman just seemed off. Chapter 3. When he heard the ding while he was sitting at his desk at Cowell & Cumley, Devine checked the message on his phone's personal email. He looked at it for a long moment, wondering whether it was a joke or he had simply lost the ability to read. "She is dead." It was the shortest of declarative sentences, its noun, verb, and predicate adjective filled with ominous potency. Then he checked out the rest of the email. Apparently, Sari Hughes had been found hanging in a storage room on the 52nd floor of the very building Devine was in, the message told him. She had been found by a janitor, her high heels lying on the floor beneath her. The woman's neck was elongated, her spine cracked, her life over. Or so the mysterious note said. She had just turned 28, Devine knew, and had been at Cowell & Cumley a little over 6 years. Hughes was tall and lean, with a long-distance runner's build. No slouch academically, she'd earned her MBA from Columbia while toiling here, and had obviously made the cut. Normally, the weed-out was complete after 1 year. Devine had been here 6 months, which meant he had another 6 to go before he was either shown the door or elevated to the next level. He looked at the missive again. "Sari dead? It can't be." Devine had secretly dated Hughes while they both worked at Cowell. They had slept together, but only once. He had wanted more, maybe much more, in the way of a relationship with her. But then it was over, and now she was dead. He focused on the sender. He didn't recognize the email address at all. In fact, he suddenly realized, it didn't look like any email address he'd ever seen. It didn't have a domain name or a suffix like .com or .gov. It wasn't the Gmail. It was just a series of numbers. Who had sent it, and how, and why to him? He looked around at the other cubicles where fingers rat-a-tatted keys and commerce moved on and fortunes were won or given back. This email hadn't gone out to his company email account. The compliance folks would be able to see all of that. This had come directly to his personal email, and no one around him was reacting like they had gotten a similar message. Am I the only one that got it? Is it for real? Is it a hoax? Is Sarah really dead? He wrote a reply to the email. Who is this? And sent it off. Then he looked at his screen and saw that his reply had failed to go. He tried again with the same result. Okay, this seems to be a one-way message stream. Devine rose and headed for the door, not one head lifted to see him leaving. Their battle was won on the screens in front of them, and by the amount of time, their butts stayed in these chairs. The pie just got one slice bigger, some of them were doubtless thinking as they heard Devine walk out. He stepped onto the elevator and headed to the 52nd floor. As he approached the 51st, on impulse, he hit the button for that floor. But even with his security card, the floor button did not light up. In his 6 months at the firm, Devine had never met anyone who had access to that floor. It was known, informally, as Area 51. He had heard rumors that no one worked on that floor. He had been on the sidewalk and counted the floors from the top down to the 51st and wondered what was really going on there. Then again, it might just be the firm's high-frequency trading platform. All the major investment houses had them. As soon as the elevator doors opened, a uniformed policeman stationed there came forward and put his hand out to stop Devine. Something's happened, thought Devine. The email wasn't the sick joke. He felt a wave of dread spill over his body. Floor's closed, sir, Devine lied and said. But I work on this floor. Not today you don't, said the cop, and he looked like he meant it. Nobody does. Devine caught the eye of Wanda Sims, a senior member of staff who had been assigned as the admin liaison for his incoming class of burners, as the group of interns was known, as in burning the candle at both ends. She hurried over to him, looking gray and haggard. He hit the button to hold the doors open.
Oh, it's terrible, Travis, just terrible. They're keeping everyone off the floor. I just had to go around and check to make sure no one was here.
She was around 50 and dressed diplomatically in the pre-approved black dress and black hose and black shoes attire of Cowell and Cumley, but it could have been Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, J.P. Morgan, Merrill Lynch, or any of the other usual suspects. Glasses dangled from a chain around her neck, along with her security RFID card on a lanyard. Why? What's happened? What's going on, Wanda? She seemed flustered enough to not wonder why he was on this floor during the workday.
You haven't heard? It's Sarah Hughes. Did you know her? I remember she was a mentor to your class of interns.
No, not very well, he lied. What happened to her?
She's dead.
He didn't have to pretend to be surprised. The realization that the message was accurate hit him like an IED. Dead? What happened?
She killed herself, or so I overheard the police saying. Hanged herself.
Oh my God. Folks, if you don't mind, thanks, butted in the cop. Sims took Devine's arm.
Come on, I can talk on the way.
She swiped her card through the reader in the elevator car and pushed the button for the ground floor.
Wait, what floor are you? I can never keep track.
I'll go all the way. I have an errand to run. She made a show of hiking her eyebrows. As a rule, death in the building or not, burners didn't leave their desks until it was time to slink home and fall asleep for a few pitiful hours before the hamster wheel started to crank again. So about Sarah? The doors closed and Sim said,
One of the custodians found her in the supply closet this morning, hanging from the ceiling. Apparently she lifted one of the panels, hung a cord around a metal pipe there, and jumped off a chair.
The person who sent me that note knew all of this. How? And why tell me? When was she supposed to have done this?
Late last night, or very, very early this morning. It seems she had on her same clothes from yesterday. I guess they can tell from the condition of the body how long she'd been dead,
she added, turning pale. Meaning she never went home?
Apparently not.
He thought about the email. Did she leave a note?
Not that I've heard. And she seemed so level-headed. You probably know she worked in the M&A division.
She added, referring to mergers and acquisitions.
She was really going places. The sky was the limit. Mr. Cowell was her personal mentor.
I can't believe she's dead.
I've never even seen a dead body. I mean, not unless it was in a coffin. Have you?
Devine eyed her and said truthfully, never in an office building.
Her parents will be an absolute wreck. They live out of the country, so it will take a bit of time for them to get here. And it certainly won't be a good look for the firm.
She put a hand to her mouth.
Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I mean, someone has died.
They reached the ground floor and Sim stepped off.
Aren't you coming?
I forgot I have something to finish up, said Devine. I'll see you later. Devine swiped his card in the reader and pushed the button for his floor. He imagined Sarah Hughes doing this yesterday and perhaps not knowing it would be the last time she ever would. Or maybe she did know. Suicides were often planned. It certainly sounded like this one had been. As he shot skyward in the elevator shaft, Devine reflected on the fact that he had not told Sims the truth, since he did know Sarah Hughes very well. Given time, they perhaps could have grown to love each other, but it hadn't turned out that way. And now Sarah Hughes was no more, and he needed to know why. Chapter 4. A cloudless, starry night, and Travis Devine was mostly unaware of it. He hadn't really looked at the sky since going to work for Cowell and Cumley. He had gone from the office to the subway, taken it to Grand Central, and was now on the evening train heading home. From there, he would walk from the station. On leaving the Cowell building, he had nodded at the night security guard, as he always did. For obvious reasons, he related to men who carried guns. The bulky man usually glanced at the clock behind his desk, nodded back, and gave him a patronizing look as if to say, really? Seriously? Is this shit really worth it, dude? Come on, how much damn money do you need? But not tonight. Not after Yu's death. They just exchanged somber looks. On the train, Devine had his AirPods in and was half listening to a financial news channel on his phone. Money was already being made and lost overseas in Asian markets that would be officially up and running in about an hour. He would rather be listening to Janis Joplin or AC/DC, but he was now a budding financial whiz with a job to do and a career to build. He had no moments to waste on Me and Bobby McGee or Highway to Hell, and with the latter, he was probably already on it. The train car was packed with weary, sweat-logged warriors, some of whom would have the next 2 days off to lick their wounds and get ready for another week's slog on Monday. He was nearly cheek to jowl with the man seated next to him. Devine's mother was a first-generation American of Greek extraction, and he had taken after her in looks, while his siblings had favored their Irish father. Devine had dark, wavy hair, olive skin, a thickened nose, rugged chin, square jawline, and deep-set eyes that seemed to automatically broadcast brooding, regardless of what he was actually thinking. Some people just thought he always looked pissed off. And maybe he was. And his 5 o'clock shadow seemed to sneak up on him at noon. It didn't look exotic or cool, it just looked grungy. He leaned toward the window when they reached the knoll, and the commuter train slowed even more. The rear lights were on in the palace of the skinny-dipping woman. He knew she had taken a chance earlier that morning by stripping down in public. These days, everybody had a camera in their phone, which put her in danger of being plastered across social media platforms for all of eternity. But maybe she didn't care, which intrigued him even more. Party lights were strung up around the outdoor area now, resembling tiny stars that had lost their buoyancy. The pool surround was littered with guests in chic dress that managed to be both casual and, he was sure, costly. It took Devine a few moments to find her in the crowd as the train ground to a stop when the mysterious signal problem reared its head once more. She had on a white clingy dress that slid to mid-thigh, and like the bikini, accented the woman's tan. Her shoes were golden stilettos. She had a drink in hand and was talking to another woman of nearly equal beauty. He watched her laugh, and the other woman followed suit. Devine wondered what they were talking about. He also wondered what made women like that laugh or be happy. Then Devine started to feel guilty and also stupid for maybe wishing he could be part of that world, especially after learning of Sarah Yu's death. I don't want to be like the guy who owns this palace. I will never be like him. I hope. He was about to turn away when he saw the very man he was thinking about walk up to the women. He was in his 40s, with short dark hair and a bulky gym build, too heavy in the arms and shoulders and too light in the legs. The army built you from the ground up, with legs and core being the dominant muscles. The frat boys always did the biceps curls and couldn't squat or deadlift shit. They looked strong and were puny. The army would kill them during basic. With his clothes and manner, the man was clearly trying to look younger and hip, and very nearly succeeding. His name was Bradley Cowell, his boss of all bosses, and the force behind Cowell and Cumley. Devine didn't know the name of the young woman who paraded at dawn in her bikini or less. It angered Devine that Cowell was having a party on the same day one of his employees had taken her own life, and a woman he was supposedly mentoring. Cowell put a hand around the blonde's hips, his fingers dancing over her bottom and then gripping it. He next planted a kiss on her that seemed to go on and on, while others around them stared and exchanged embarrassed smiles.
Damn, lucky son of a bitch. I mean, look at that shit. Look, dude.
Devine turned to see the beefy, perspiring young man in a dark blue Brooks Brothers suit next to him, staring at what he was staring at. He could sense both the man's sweaty stink and his lousy envy.
All about the damn money, opined Sweaty. But that's gonna be me one day, swear to God.
And he sounded like he meant it. Devine stared at him for a moment, perhaps seeing himself in the man's fired-up rhetoric. When he had told his father he was getting an MBA, the old man was thrilled. When he'd gotten the job at Cowell and Cumley, Devine Sr. had taken his son out to dinner, and they had even gotten drunk together. It was the first time Devine had had that sort of experience with his father. It had been intoxicating, and he wasn't talking about the booze. It was the first time Devine could remember his father being proud of him. And it was the first time Devine, as an adult, had felt positive feelings toward his old man. And when he woke up the next morning, he had never felt more depressed. This wasn't about reward. This wasn't about making money and owning his own palace one day, or making his father proud. That ship had long since sailed. This was about paying one's debts. The train gathered speed as the signal problem vanished. Later, Devine trudged out of the station. He would walk home, go to sleep, and then rise early. He would perform the workout he had pretty much done every day since leaving the army. He would shower in the darkness, eat his breakfast, and head to this very same station as the sun rose. At least tomorrow was Saturday, which meant he had only one more day of toil until his only day off for the week. But his plans were about to be disrupted. Chapter 5.
Mr. Devine? Travis Devine?
He looked over as the man got out of the car parked in front of the station, which also housed an Italian restaurant.
Yeah?
The man walked over. He was black, about Devine's height, and lean, maybe 45 or a bit older. Bald head and furrowed skin on his brow. He wore a dark blue suit that looked good on his athletic frame. His shoes were black and rubber-soled. He flashed a badge and an official ID housed in a cred pack, like he was a magician doing a card trick.
Detective Carl Hancock, NYPD.
Devine grew rigid.
What can I do for you? You mind coming over to the car where we can talk?
What about?
Come on, what do you think? Sarah Hughes. She's dead. Didn't you know that?
Devine didn't like the guy's manner. It was blunt and seemed to leap to lots of conclusions. The brown eyes, clearly visible under the streetlight, scrutinized Devine and came away suspicious.
I heard about it, along with everyone else. Right. This way, sir, if you don't mind. Won't take long. That's what they always say, and before you know it, years have gone by.
He sat in the passenger seat of the car, where the smell of spilled coffee and the vapory veil of cigarette smoke was suffocating. Hancock rolled down a window and said,
Sorry about that. Fact is, I don't smoke and I don't drink coffee, and this isn't my ride, and they ain't supposed to smoke in here, but they do. Motor pool checkout. Serious budget cuts. Don't think they bought new wheels for 10 years or so. Gotta dry clean my clothes every time I pull duty in one.
No problem. I've smelled a lot worse.
That would be first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, correct, Captain Devine?
He didn't like that the NYPD knew this about him. That showed they had already investigated him and sent a detective all the way out here on the very day Sarah's body was found. Former captain. And I've been to bars in the city that smelled worse than those places.
You were wounded. Twice. But you look all there.
Yeah, in all the places you can see. Hancock's demeanor changed.
Is that right? You got problems up here?
He tapped his temple.
No, I'm just fine up there.
Devine slid up his pants leg to reveal a thick, hardened scar that wrapped both ways around his calf like the tentacles of an octopus. If you ever wanted to see the bomb pattern of an IED, there it is. Hancock glanced at the old wound and said,
Damn, looks like it hurt.
I didn't have time to feel it. The blast knocked me ass over heels unconscious. But when I woke up, I did. Thank God for morphine. He let his trouser leg drop.
But I thought you wanted to ask about Sarah Hughes.
The official notebook came out.
You knew her?
Yes.
How?
Asked Hancock.
We worked at the same firm, Cal and Cumley, but you knew that. So how exactly did you know her?
We met at some company mixers. We went out in groups for drinks, some dinners before the recruitment BS was over and our noses got pressed to the grindstone. She was sort of a mentor to my intern class.
How did she strike you?
Talented and hard-charging. But why did you come all the way out here to ask me questions? I was there all day. I'll be there tomorrow. And my understanding was she died by suicide, so why are the police involved?
It's speculated that she killed herself. My job is to rule out all other manners of death.
And you work on Saturdays? In my world, detective, it's only the day after Friday, and I don't see how I can help. I didn't work directly with her. I haven't seen her in months, in fact. Last time was a group dinner at Per Se, Columbus Circle. Over 50 people, with wine included. Must have cost the firm a small fortune, but it's only money.
Impressive memory. I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday.
His words were flippant. His stare was not.
And the only time I'll ever be inside Per Se is if someone croaks there.
In my line of work, you tend to remember things pretty exactly.
You work hard at that place, I take it.
Let's put it this way. I have but one set of balls to give for Cal and Cumley, and that might not be enough.
You're funny for an investment type.
I just crunch numbers and give them to the real investment bankers, and they make all the money and get all the girls.
How much money are we talking about?
Devine knew the man didn't really need to know this for his investigation. It was very American to be nosy about the wealth of the very rich. Whole industries were built around disseminating that information to the fascinated masses. The firm has various divisions, and the comp and profit sharing are split differently depending on which camp you fall into. Partners on the very low end get mid-seven figures. People like Bradley Cowell, maybe a quarter of a billion or more per year in official comp and stock options. He also gets percentages of all the profit streams, so that goes on top of his base. Hancock was shaking his head this whole time.
I make 110 grand a year, and I thought I was doing great until you laid that shit on me.
How do you think I feel? I don't even make what you make, and I see all those dollars on the screen every day, and they just pass right by me. The man's eyes glittered once more, like a dog picking up a scent.
And so you resent that? Them getting all the girls and the dough.
I resent no one about anything. You work hard, you earn it, it's yours. I hope to do the same.
And the girls? Like Sarah Hughes? Give me a break, okay? I can get girls if I want to. And Cowell has a strict rule against employees dating. If he finds out we were seeing each other, I'm screwed. Okay. Anything else about yous? Like what? The usual, depressed, ever spoke to you about suicide? Probably everyone who works on Wall Street at one time or another has contemplated suicide, either in pitiful jest or for real. That includes you? Asked Hancock. Look, I saw guys shot up, blown up, and cut up right in front of me. I'm not taking my own life because a Wall Street firm busts my chops. So nothing else you can tell me. Devine glanced out the car window and seemed truly amazed to see the stars in the sky. His next words were said in a calm, even tone, because that was how he was suddenly feeling. Sarah was a nice person. She never talked to me about killing herself. She never seemed depressed, quite the opposite. She used to pep us up when we were getting ground down, but like I said, it's been a while. And even a day at Cowell and Cumley is like a lifetime, Detective Hancock. So why stay? Devine assumed a stoic look and hit the play button in his head. It's the American dream. I'm trying to create my own. You don't strike me as the type to give a shit about making truckloads of money. You must have me confused with someone else. I do want the money and everything that comes with it. But there are a lot of things you can do with that money. You can use it to help other people. So you're busting your ass to help others, Hancock said with a shit-eating grin. I did it in the army. Any reason I can't do it on Wall Street? Come on, just tell me the truth. It can't be that bad. But Devine didn't open his mouth because he had nothing more to say. And it was that bad. Chapter 6. Hancock had offered to drive Devine home, probably just to see where he lived. Devine accepted, and a few minutes later he climbed out of the car in front of the white two-story brick townhouse with a one-car detached garage that was part of a small community of like structures. It was not poor, it was not rich, and neither was it just right. Nice place, said Hancock. It's the only thing I could really afford this close in that had trees and some grass. You think this is close in? Where do you commute in from? Hancock smiled and said, Trenton, I rest my case, and I'm not even a lawyer. If I need to follow up on stuff, you know where I live and work. I'm easy to find. I'm not going anywhere unless Cowell and Cumley decides to pull my plug. If so, you can catch me at the unemployment office. Hancock drove off in his ratty motor pool coffee and nicotine ride. Black smoke poured out of the tailpipe and coated the white brick and Devine with a nice, cozy blanket of carcinogens. Coughing, he unlocked the door and walked in. The front room held one of his three roommates, the big-bellied Will Valentine. He worked from home and was employed as a white hatter, a person hired by tech firms and banks and other industries to try to hack through their security systems. They had become friends, and Valentine had even taught Devine some ingenious ways to electronically sneak into various databases. He was also Russian, but had changed his name to something very American. He had shown Devine his passport. His real name was long and unpronounceable, at least for Devine. Lots of consonants strung together had never been his thing.
I get many more girls with American name, Valentine had explained. But I tell clients truth that I am Russian. They know we are best at hacking. You wait and see, I will get rich. I fucking love capitalism, and I love your women.
Devine never could tell if the guy knew he was playing a Hollywood version of a Russian now free in America, or if he really was like that. Valentine was now snoring softly on the sofa, mumbling in his native language. To Devine, spoken Russian always sounded menacing, as though the spoken words were uniformly, "And now you will die horribly, comrade." Valentine's laptop was perched on his substantial gut and was being lifted into the air with each inhale and dipping with every exhale. The TV was on, but muted. It looked to be one of those limited series that moved at the speed of light, just begging to be binged. An open and empty Domino's pizza box was on the carpet next to the couch.
twin empty bottles of Michelob rested next to it. The Russian was definitely an American in diet now. Devine went over and touched the open laptop. Its screen came to life, but didn't reveal its treasure box of data. A large dragon came on instead and breathed a wall of fire at the attempted digital trespassing. Cute, thought Devine. He peered into the dining room, which held not a stick of furniture, but only a human being. Another roommate, a black woman named Helen Spears, was on a mat in the middle of the green carpet doing yoga. She was barefoot and performing a downward dog pose in a tight-fitting Lycra one-piece. Spears had just graduated from law school at NYU and was almost never home before Devine was. She was petite and lithe and lovely, and one day she would be in court righteously carving people up with the law. "Early night," he said. Spears had AirPods in. She nodded and said between deep yoga breaths,
"Got stood up on a drink in Soho, if you can believe that. I'm releasing endorphins in retaliation."
"No, I can't believe that," he replied, but she had moved on to child's pose and wasn't listening. He walked up the stairs to the second floor. His third and final roommate, Jill Tapshaw, was a truly brilliant person who had started her own online dating company known as Hummingbird. He marveled at her guts and drive and brain operating on a different plane from the rest of the world. While Valentine and Spears had come to live here about the same time Devine had, Tapshaw had been here only a little over 4 months, but she was friendly and outgoing, and he had gotten to know her. Her company was a true startup because she ran it from her bedroom and also from a two-room office in a strip mall in downtown Mount Kisco, about a half mile from here. She had 5 full-time employees other than herself and about 3 dozen independent contractors working remotely, she'd told him. They specialized in bringing together people fearful of reaching out on their own or of enduring the usual online dating experience. It was a need, and she had filled it. Tapshaw had told Devine the site already had millions of users and over 100,000 paid subscribers from all over the world.
"And we're now adding tens of thousands of new users a day. We raised $500,000 in our round A and $5 million in our B a year later. I'm projecting a home run for a round C at 5 times that at a great valuation. Next, we tack on some tasteful piggyback ads and banner bucks for peripheral revenue streams. With enough capital, I can dominate my space. And then we execute different but compatible product silos under separate corporate entities, all under Hummingbird's umbrella brand, to provide a sort of dating-to-grave experience. You want to invest? It's still relatively cheap. Last chance. Friends and family and roommate discount."
Cal and Cumley paid shit to the Burners. They just did their 80 to 90 hour grunt work weeks in the hopes of the payoff at the end. Most of Devine's money went for rent and the ride in and out. And then there was that other thing called food. But nevertheless, though he legally wasn't a qualified investor under the securities laws, he'd bought $1,000 worth of stock in the little bird that flitted around flowers sucking up nectar and paying it forward. Which was where she had gotten the name, Tapshaw had told him.
"You can spend $100,000 on a branding firm to come up with horseshit, and then focus group the hell out of it for another $100,000, or you can do it on your own for free."
He tapped on her bedroom door and called out her name.
"Getting ready to Zoom with a Taiwanese venture capital group,"
Tapshaw's voice barked.
"Their birth rate is plummeting. Is it urgent? Is the place on fire? Are you bleeding to death, Travis?"
"No," he called through the door. "All good, just don't forget to eat." She kept a jar of peanut butter and a stack of celery sticks in a glass with water in her room. She was thinner than a rake and seemed to prefer it that way. She'd told Devine she hadn't been on a single date in over a year, not even digitally.
"Do as I say, not as I don't do,"
Tapshaw had quipped. Restless and edgy, and not wanting to sleep despite being tired, Devine went to his room, changed into athletic shorts and a t-shirt and Saucony running shoes. He left the house and had just started his run when a black sedan pulled up beside him. There were 2 men inside, serious-looking men, suits and shades, even in the gathering darkness.
"Mr. Devine,"
Travis Devine, a strange man said for the second time tonight. He stopped running and said, Yeah? The man flashed a badge, a federal one, with an agency Devine instantly recognized.
Your presence is requested. Please get in.
Requested by who? The man moved just enough so Devine could see the pistol in the shoulder holster.
Get in.
Devine looked around, and like the soldier he had once been, he followed orders and got in. Chapter 7. The ride took 30 minutes. They were heading south toward the city. Neither man spoke, and Devine knew better than to ask questions. First the NYPD, and now the feds. He didn't like all this personal attention. They pulled off into a small town, much like Mount Kisco, extremely affluent in some parts, just as extremely working class in others. They drove to the very back of a nondescript office park where there was a single brick building. There were no cars parked out front, and no signs on the building. The windows were blacked out, and it looked abandoned. The man parked and got out along with his colleague. He held the car door open for Devine, and they walked up to the front of the building. The man flashed an RF card in the face of a reader port, and Devine heard the door click open. This was looking both way too official and far too clandestine. He figured neither boded well for him.
I shot the sheriff, but I did not shoot the deputy.
The driver led the way inside, Devine in the middle, the other guy bringing up the rear. Devine would have expected nothing less. It was the way you transported either prisoners or soon-to-be prisoners. Automatic lights came on as they walked through an open space. Devine was led to an interior door. The man knocked, and a voice said,
Come.
The door was opened, and the man motioned Devine in. He closed the door, and Devine looked around the small space, and then at the man sitting behind the desk.
Sit down, Devine, said the man. We have a lot to go over, so pay attention. There is no time to waste.
Devine sat. The fellow looked like a well-worn slab of granite. His gray hair was bristly and cut short. His features were chiseled and fierce. The salt-and-pepper eyebrows swooped in all directions. The decades-old suit never had been expensive or of good quality when brand new, but it was so unremarkable as to still be serviceable now. The red and blue striped tie was too wide for the times, the collared button-down shirt a bit worn around the edges. He couldn't see the man's shoes from here, but if he had to guess, Devine would speculate they were black and pedestrian and shined to spit-polish perfection. There was something about him, his bearing, the way he gave commands, because they were commands, the breadth of the shoulders, the ominous thickness of the hands. He was now a suit who was once a soldier. Devine could just tell, and really still a soldier, because it gets into your DNA, and there is no way to separate it from you. It becomes you. The man silently studied him.
Gauging the size of my balls.
Devine stared back, waiting. He had done this so many times with military superiors that it was second nature.
Exemplary record at West Point. Then infantry officer basic, ranger school, jump school, striker battalion out of Fort Lewis, line platoon company commander for a year and a half with a string of commendations, made first lieutenant right on schedule, company XO for 6 months, next up line platoon commander, ranger battalion, so your ranger tabbed and scrolled,
added the man, referring to the fact that Devine had graduated from ranger school and been assigned to the 75th Ranger Regiment.
Promoted to captain and got your silver bars right at the 4-year mark. Bradley company commander out of Fort Stewart for 18 months, then ranger battalion out of Hunter Army Airfield, ranger company commander, then staff officer. All along the way, tours of combat duty in Afghanistan and then Iraq, and special ops missions in 10 other shitstorm countries, where if you messed up, you get a flag on your coffin and a dignified transfer at Dover Air Force Base.
Devine was impressed that the man had recited his military CV from memory. Some parts of it even Devine had forgotten. The man leaned back in his chair and studied Devine.
You have shrapnel on your shoulder and leg, and they'll stay with you until the day you die.
You were picked up for 04 Major at the 8-year mark below the zone, he added, referring to the Army's esoteric promotion vernacular. In due time, you would have had the golden oak leaf on your uniform, Divine. And then you quit. I wonder why. The man didn't ask it as a question. He had thrown it out as a statement. But still, Divine decided to try to answer. I did my time. I took my shots, and pretty much all of them hit the target. They took their shots at me. Some hit, most missed. I moved on. It was time. I didn't relish pressing my luck. Don't bullshit me, son. I don't have the patience. My name is Emerson Campbell, retired Army 2-star. Never got the 3rd or 4th ones because I don't play the political games necessary to do that. And so let me be clear, former Captain Divine. I know exactly why you left the service, and it has nothing to do with your luck running out. He opened a manila folder that was lying in front of him. He took out some photos and arrayed them in front of Divine. He pointed to one picture. Lieutenant Roy Blankenship. You knew him. You served together. He pointed to another photo. Captain Kenneth Hawkins. You knew him. Served with him as well. So what? Patience, Divine. We've been interested in you for a while now. Is that right? Who do you think got you the room at that townhouse in Mount Kisco?
Divine's eyes widened at this. A realtor who was a friend.
Right. A friend of a friend. We have lots of friends, Divine, who do what they're told.
Why did you care where I lived?
Let's just say it was a convenient spot for us, considering we have this office nearby, and you take the train in, and you pass a certain house there every day, right?
The man could only mean one thing. Brad Cowell's palace, you mean?
Palace, eh? You're right, and I'm glad you picked things up fast. Maybe our time won't be wasted.
He took out another picture, clearly a morgue shot of the now-deceased Roy Blankenship with ligature marks around his neck.
He was killed, murdered, you also know that. Even though Army CID ruled it a suicide. The guy was cremated, evidence lost, a total clusterfuck. But you know who killed him. Kenneth Hawkins, his superior officer, his comrade in arms, did the honors. And you know exactly why he did it.
Says who? Muttered Divine. He was feeling sullen and trapped because he was, and he also knew exactly where this was headed.
Says the evidence. Hawkins murdered Blankenship and made it look like a suicide. He got away with it. Until he didn't, as you know. But to refresh your memory.
He took out another photo of a very dead Kenneth Hawkins.
And you know who killed Hawkins?
Do I? Divine felt every muscle in his body tense. The nightmare had finally come home to roost. He could feel the walls of the small space close in around him.
Hey, it was a nice, if short, ride. But you've got to pay the piper. I guess I did shoot the deputy after all.
You do, because you killed him, replied Campbell.
I didn't kill him.
You two fought out in the Moonscape Mountains of Afghanistan. He was badly injured from that fight. You walked away and left him. He died there. You could have saved him. You chose not to. How would you describe that?
You have no proof of...
We have proof of everything, enough to take years of your life away. With that said, I'm going to make you an offer that is akin to your winning the goddamn lottery, son. Now, the choice for you is astoundingly simple. Those men outside are Army CID special agents. You can either go with them to be charged and thrown in the brig to await a military trial.
Divine interrupted.
You can't court-martial me. I'm a civilian now.
Civilian courts have ruled that military retirees can be prosecuted under military law for crimes committed after they left the service. In your case, the crime was done while you were in uniform, so there is no question that the Army will be the one prosecuting your case, and you will be convicted and sent to USDB for a very long time.
Campbell added, referring to the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, the military's max security prison.
Unless you agree to work with us.
And who exactly is us?
The shop I run now. There's a small office within the Department of Homeland Security and has a joint operation agreement with the Department of Defense. It's aptly called the Office of Special Projects. It has about 500 operatives, of which I control 50. I'd like to make you the 51st. It has a wide latitude of core interests, with the security of this nation driving all of them. When I took off the uniform, I didn't forget my oath. Did you? What do you want me to do? A woman died at your place of employment. Sarah Hughes, yes? You knew her. I did. The fact is, there is something going on at Cowlin Comley, Divine. Something seriously not right. We have heard chatter, we have run down a few leads, but we have made no real progress, and we have no grounds to execute a search warrant or bring people in for questioning, and we're light years from federal prosecutors impaneling a grand jury. We need information, Divine. A lot of it. We need to ferret out whatever the hell is going on there. You are admirably suited to investigate this matter since you are already there. That is the reason you're here. That is why we've been watching you. That is why you now live in Mount Kisco and why you pass Cowell's house every day. We want Bragg Cowell badly, and we need your help to do it.
So I'm to be your plant inside.
I don't care what nomenclature you use. I just want results.
And if I do what you ask and I'm successful,
then you will have accomplished the mission, and I will ask you to serve your country again as a member of the Office of Special Projects.
And when does this service end? Asked Divine. Campbell glanced down at the photos of the dead men.
You ended Hawkins' life about 50 years early. What is avoiding the consequences of that worth to you?
If you know all about it, as you claim to, then maybe you understand why I did what I did. I tried like hell to get CID to take a second look. I went through my chain of command and got stonewalled. Hawkins had friends at high levels, and the Army didn't want the bad optics of one officer's killing another.
I understand perfectly. I might have done as you did in the same circumstances. However, the law makes no exception. But I am giving you a chance to avoid the penalty that would befall anyone else in your situation. You might consider yourself the luckiest bastard on Earth. Hence my reference to your winning the lottery.
He paused.
So what is your decision? Because I need it right now.
But I can't promise that I'll find out what you want me to. I can only promise to do my best. Will that cut it?
When does a soldier ever get a pass on trying to complete a mission? You either complete it or you don't. You sure as hell know the United States Army doesn't hand out participation trophies, son.
If Sarah hadn't been killed, would you have just arrested me instead of making this offer?
I don't answer pointless questions. Are you in, or do I call the CID boys to do their thing?
It was a choice in name only.
I'm in, said Divine.
Campbell took out a file from a desk drawer.
Excellent. Now let's get down to basics so you can better understand exactly what it is we want you to do.
A good soldier, apparently, once more, Divine settled back to receive a briefing and his orders going forward. Chapter 8. Divine was dropped off back at his home. He went to his room, looked up Emerson Campbell online, and saw the same stern face staring back at him. A Vietnam platoon leader involved in some of the most hellish battles of that long, ugly war, Campbell was the recipient of nearly every combat medal under the sun. He was also, like Divine, Ranger-tabbed and Ranger-scrolled. He had been engaged in pretty much every combat situation the United States had during the intervening years, including the First and Second Gulf Wars. He'd ended up a 2-star commanding Fort Benning in Georgia, where Divine had earned his Ranger status, though their paths had not crossed there. He had the rep of being iron hard but fair, a soldier's soldier. He cared more for his troops than he did for the next star on his shoulder. Then his career had seemed to stall. One article reported that Campbell had been brutally honest during some congressional testimony. And the Army brass hadn't liked that level of candor from one of its senior officers.
He'd then been apparently forced into retirement and gone into the private sector. He'd resurfaced a few years later with some civilian position at the Pentagon. After that, he'd dropped off the radar. Well, the old man was back on the battlefield, it seemed. Devine stripped off his running clothes and changed into jeans, heavy boots, and a long-sleeved t-shirt, then grabbed his motorcycle helmet and went downstairs and out the back. In the one-car garage was Tapshaw's Hunter Green Mini Cooper. She was the only one with a car for her one-mile jaunt to work. Spears took the train into the city like Devine did, and Valentine performed his heavenly hacking remotely from his room, or the couch. Next to the Mini was Devine's BMW motorcycle. It was the only thing he had ever splurged on. He'd bought it used with money saved up from his army pay. He fired up the motorcycle and soared off into the night. He had been given a mission, and as a soldier, he had never liked to let time lapse between an order given and its execution. The problem was the file that Campbell had on Cowell and Cumley was very thin, but there was enough there that Devine could understand someone like Campbell being deployed to see what was up. And now I'm right in the middle of it, sink or swim. He zipped along curvy roads, going faster than he should have at night, but he didn't really care. At least he was finally flying along with a purpose beyond making money for Brad Cowell, a man who already had far too much wealth. 10 minutes later, he arrived at Cowell's private enclave, the rear of which he saw from his train every morning. It was ablaze with lights, like a movie premiere, for all to see. High-dollar showroom-level cars were parked in the palace's motor court. Wrought iron gates kept out the uninvited, of which Devine was assuredly one. He took off his helmet and watched. The people he had seen from the train earlier were filtering out now. No doubt they had to get back to their fabulous homes and do fabulous things before getting up the next day to continue being fabulous. But maybe he was just being fabulously cynical and envious. As he continued to watch, his focus suddenly centered on one man. It was the thick-chested and skinny-legged Bradley Cowell in the flesh. He slid clumsily into the driver's seat of a deep blue Bugatti Chiron that probably cost more than Devine would earn in 10 years, even if he did make it at the firm. Cowell fired up the engine, and it sounded like a Boeing 777 powering up to takeoff thrust. He slid it into gear and in 2 seconds made it to the gates, which barely had time to open on the motion sensor before the muscle car blew past. He turned right and headed south. Devine knew Cowell had a penthouse on the top of the building where Devine labored every day. He might be going there tonight, swapping a palace in the burbs for sleeping closer to the sky. Devine kicked the bike into gear and raced after the Bugatti. He had a second job now. It was called serving his country once more and keeping out of prison.